My Family Thinks I'm Crazy, a podcast where I, your host, try to give you some tips on how you can explain all this weird, wild, crazy conspiracy stuff to the people you love most. Because that's what I've been trying to do for the past 10 years with no success. I've been telling everybody that our government is shady. They're just like, oh, here we go, Mark. Off again with your...
Mark being Mark again.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's the thing about podcasts is when you're on the air, and it's like therapy, you know? If I can't talk to my family about this stuff, I'll talk to you, Matt, and all our listeners.
You'll just tell your whole podcast.
Yeah. So who are we talking about today, Matt?
Is reality objective? Is it material? Could we have been taught a completely upside down way to make sense of these concepts? And if so, was this done purposefully to limit our abilities to perceive and engage with our own supernatural realm? After today's conversation with accomplished author Mark Gober, you may be asking yourself the same questions. So join the conversation on patreon.com/mftic or myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com, where there's an entire other hour of this very conversation with Mark Gober. So don't miss out. Go to patreon.com/mftic or myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com. Now here's a sneak preview of what we talk about in the second hour. I'll see you there.
A broader problem that I do mention in my book. It's the lack of a unifying theory in physics, because the two leading theories are Einstein's relativity, which we talked about is a big problem given dark matter, and quantum mechanics, which I know some people question as well. But in any event, they're the two main theories, and they're supposed to work well in their respective domains. So quantum is supposed to work really well in the small scale, which to me is actually confusing, because if quantum is the part of our reality that embeds everything, shouldn't it apply to the bigger cosmos too fully? And there was a webinar by Dr. Tom Cowan, who does a lot on questioning germ theory and viruses, but he did a webinar recently talking about quantum mechanics. And he says he's been asking physicists, like, what's the point? Like, how small does it have to be where it switches into the quantum, where it works really well? Like, what's that threshold? A really clever question to ask, because I've never heard a good answer to that. But in any event, quantum and relativity, these are the two leading theories of physics, and they're supposed to work well in their relative domains. Relativity works well at the big scales of galactic stuff and huge planets revolving around others, and quantum works at the microscopic scale. But when you put them together, the equations metaphorically blow up. And I quote Michio Kaku in my book, a mainstream physicist, who says that we end up with the biggest mismatch in the history of physics or something. He says we're off by 10 to the 120th power. And if we were off by way less, we would call that a bad thing. So by physics' own standard, they've got big problems. There's no unifying theory of physics. No.
I think we're past that. Hopefully with Trump's YouTube, we won't have to worry about that anymore. But apparently the only phrase you can't say nowadays on YouTube is that vaccines make you magnetic. So, okay. But every other variation of the word vaccine is fine, I guess. So,
okay.
Anyways.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, here we are back again on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. And with me today is a returning guest, someone who has done a tour de force of books, a series of books which I think everyone should have on their shelf. It's fundamental to the alternative viewpoints that we talk about so much on this show. Mark Gober returns. And Mark, we've talked a little bit about your past on your previous interview, your career in the world of high finance, and you know, you graduated from Princeton, which is a very prestigious Ivy League school. So you come from what we would expect to be sort of a mainstream, you know, stereotypical outlook on the world. Maybe you did have that, but tell us a little bit for people who might not be remembering our first conversation, your background and how you transformed the way you saw things and how you came to that.
Yeah, I wish you and your audience had met me like 8+ years ago because it's so different. I mean, I guess the essence of who I am hasn't changed that much, but in terms of what I'm focused on, it's so different. Mm. I was, like you said, went to Princeton, graduated in 2008, and that was during the financial crisis. I had a job lined up at UBS, one of the big investment banks. And so I went to New York after I graduated. It was a really tough time to be there in terms of just the workload and the culture. And then I left New York in 2010. I joined a firm first in Boston, but primarily my time was in Silicon Valley, advising technology-focused companies on their patented technologies, so their innovations and their strategy around it, legally, technologically, and just business-wise. And I was just on this treadmill of trying to achieve the next thing that was in front of me. And it was sort of like it was never enough. No matter what I would achieve, it felt like I went back to baseline in terms of just happiness and overall life satisfaction. And I, at the time, I thought that life didn't have any meaning to it, meaning that we lived in a random universe and there wasn't any spiritual intelligence or God or anything like that. So I was an atheist or an agnostic, and it became harder and harder to just live that way. But I thought there was no other choice, and I had to suck it up because science was telling us that there's nothing to any spiritual or religious beliefs. That's just all superstition, and science has transcended it. So that's very squarely where I was in 2016, and not doing so great at the time just because I was struggling with meaning and purpose and like, why am I working so hard? What I've been doing my whole life. I was 30 at the time. And then I started listening to podcasts sort of as a hobby outside the office. At the time, podcasts weren't quite as big, but I was listening to Tim Ferriss at first, and he was sort of alternative, like listening to him talk to venture capitalists. And then I heard him do some alternative health shows. So he was talking about psychedelics, and I wasn't comfortable going down that route, but he was also talking about doing sensory deprivation, like float tanks and meditation. So I was like, oh, why don't I go do a sensory deprivation tank in San Francisco where you literally float in salt water in the dark? And it's very relaxing. That probably influenced things in ways that I don't even know. So I was experimenting with stuff like that and just being curious. And then I came across a podcast episode on Extreme Health Radio. A woman named Laura Powers was talking about her use of psychic abilities with clients. And this was someone who had an advanced degree in like politics and was working in higher education and like seemed kind of normal. And she was talking about communicating with spirits on a health show. And it was like, I've never heard anyone really talk like this before. And at the end of that show, Laura talked about her own podcast called Healing Powers. And she's like, well, I interview a lot of other people that do this sort of thing. So I just listened to her podcast, and it was person after person describing these things that I would have called paranormal before. But I realized the only reason I would have called it paranormal is that I thought normal was something that was wrong. So I had to change my view of normal. And I started reading books and scientific papers about just the nature of consciousness, psychic abilities, what happens when we die, the afterlife, reincarnation. And I went down a big rabbit hole, wrote my first book. After a year of doing that, I just said, I've got to write. Even though I was still working in Silicon Valley, I just said, this is so important. It's changing my life. I want to share it with people. So that was my first book, An End to Upside Down Thinking. Came out in 2018. 2019, I did a podcast series with Blue Duck Media, just 8 episodes. It's still available, called Where Is My Mind? And that was on the same topic where I just interviewed the people I wrote about. That took me to the end of 2019, early 2020. And I said, look, I'm a partner at my firm now, but I'm too interested in these other areas. I'm going to leave the firm, not knowing what my next thing is going to be. So I ended up leaving. And since then, I've written 5 more books. But basically, when everything started to happen around COVID, I became exposed to this whole other area of upside down things that I was not on my radar when I was just researching consciousness. I saw all the corruption in the media and the deception in the medical industry with politics, because previously I had no interest in politics. Like, if you had asked me what's left or right, I really didn't even know that stuff, if you can believe it, because I was just so focused on other things. And then I saw a huge difference when, I mean, it mattered. It was everything. And starting in 2020 with the election and just beliefs about COVID, all these people that I really respected and still do respect in terms of their views on consciousness and certain spiritual beliefs, they went hard left, just went all with the mainstream narrative, very pro-vaccine agenda. And I was learning about a lot of other stuff that was completely contradicting it. So I'm sitting there just so confused because I learned all this stuff about consciousness. And now most of those people were going down a rabbit hole that just seemed like the wrong direction. So I've been recalibrating a lot of other beliefs in the last few years, and most recently wrote about cosmology, which challenges the Big Bang, heliocentrism, what is Earth, the shape, and all that. But I mentioned that book because it's the last thing I've done. There's a lot of other stuff that I did before I even explored that topic deeply. So I know we're probably going to spend a lot of time looking at that today, but I just want to emphasize that's not where I started. I didn't come into this saying like, oh, I just think everything's fake and everything's a lie and we live on a flat earth. It took a long time to even explore those questions. And most recently, that Cosmos book just came out.
Yeah, and I think that just adds to your credibility, the authenticity of your experience of taking the route that I think most, you know, when you're looking at an American life and you're thinking about your family, you want your children to have a path that you went down. Like you went down an exemplary path. You're an achiever. You've achieved amazing goals. I think you have a lot to show for that, and that's incredible. But at the same time, and I've heard you express this in our first conversation and in other conversations I've heard you have, where, you know, that like winning mindset that is now propelling you through this, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but it was being applied in a way that was not fulfilling, right? Can we talk a little bit about that? And like, you know, because I think a lot of people whose families think they're crazy have woken up to that, and they're still dealing with the interpersonal relationships and all the things that come with having these connections to people who haven't made that change. So they're offloading their stress and the trauma of this fast-paced lifestyle onto the people, and then also judging them for maybe not working as hard as them, right? So it's a very interesting sociological, you know, dilemma we find ourselves in.
Yeah, this was particularly difficult for me in 2016 while I was still in the heart of this achievement mindset. And then the rug got pulled out from under me when I learned about these other things. And I felt extremely isolated at the time because no one in my network talked about this stuff. And I didn't realize how big a community there was of people who were asking questions about the nature of reality and even beyond it. So that was super disorienting for me. And eventually as I learned more, I became more comfortable speaking about it. And then writing a book gave me more comfort. Then I met a lot of people. So that's what I found, is that when I go out on a limb, and each book is an incremental limb that I'm going out on, where I seem to isolate myself even more. Like, yeah, after the first six books, a lot of people supported me. You write this book on cosmology, you're crazy. My sixth book on medicine, Mark, we liked you before, but you're talking about no virus and you're challenging germ theory. Oh, we didn't like you. We don't like you anymore. Mark, we like your work on consciousness. And then I'm talking about voluntarism and getting rid of compulsory government. Mark, you're crazy. So there has been, for me, it's been sequential and like and a continuous thing. What I found, though, is that if I can make a very clear argument in my mind, and the book writing process helps me, like if I can give logic and have credible sources to back up each piece of the logic, then I feel like I have to do it. And if I get past that threshold, then it's like I almost don't care what people think, because I know within myself that I'm doing the right thing. And then I seem to find people that are down with it also. And then I just want to go back to something you were talking about in terms of like applying the achievement mindset, which, I mean, a lot of the things I even learned while I was using that achievement mindset, I don't even agree with. I spent time learning things that I think are false. So in that sense, it almost feels like a waste. Like, how many hours did I spend studying things? But I did learn a process of learning, and I ingrained it almost in a militaristic fashion, because I was working so hard all the time. And it was like, whether it was school or in my jobs, there was always something cracking the whip. And then also what I used to do for my clients, especially in Silicon Valley, I would have crazy deadlines where I would have to learn about an entire new technology that I wasn't familiar with, and then be able to understand it enough and the business context to explain it to a board of directors or a management team that just wanted like, hey, Mark, give it to me in 5 minutes and don't make sure none of it's wrong. So I had to do this stuff, but most people wouldn't see it because we were under non-disclosure agreements and maybe like a few people in the world would see those things. But I learned a lot about learning in addition to my education at Princeton. So like you said, I'm taking the things that I, from the part of my life that maybe I didn't agree with, and I don't agree with now in terms of the content as much, but I there's a lot that I learned that I can apply to this other area. So I say that to your audience, because for all of us, there are skills that we might be getting, even if we're in a place that we don't want to be long-term, that might we can apply to these other areas.
Absolutely. Yeah, I see that in my own life path. You know, I dropped out of college and really spent some time wandering around New Haven, which is now what I love to research, you know, Yale's history, New Haven's history, and then, you know, being a delivery driver through different synchronicities gave me this like huge amount of free time to listen to podcasts. And when it clicked in my mind, because, you know, you got to pay to go to college to learn, right? But it clicked in my mind, oh, wow, I'm getting paid to learn all day, because this job requires no, you know, intellectual input. It's a literally GPS telling me every step of my day. So I just listen to podcasts and focus on that. And it was, you know, sort of a calling. And I really respect that in you answering this calling and seeing, you know, all of what was maybe missing from your then worldview and going, okay, wow, I got to assimilate this, because this is not the whole picture. And so many people, I think, are afraid to make that leap. And maybe it's because of the way society has entrained us. Maybe it's the things that we're committed to. But I do want to comment on the trajectory of your books, given that you started with An End to Upside Down Thinking, An End to Upside Down Living. Obviously, An End to Upside Down Liberty was very much influenced by what was going on in the world. And we spent some time talking about that in our last conversation. But then An End to Upside Down Contact follows that End to Upside Down Liberty. And I'm wondering, you know, was that almost like, all right, I've spent so much time on this stuff that is so like material, I need to like literally go outer space right now? Like, where did An End to Upside Down Contact fit into the trajectory of the first three?
So when I was researching the political corruption and deception around COVID in 2020, the concept of evil inevitably shows up. And that gets into some really dark stuff, like rituals to invoke demonic beings, possession. And what I was trying to understand is like, how do those dark forces fit into what's happening in the world? Because to me, it seems so dark. They're locking us down. There's so much deception. At the time in 2020, 2021, we didn't know how long this stuff was going to last. We didn't know if there were going to be passports based on injections that you've taken and all that stuff. So I was really, really worried and looking at the nature of evil a lot, which I didn't look at quite as much in my first two books, Thinking and Living. So then I wrote Liberty, and where I'm talking about an argument against the state and in favor of voluntarism, at least theoretically. And in that book, I talk about the metaphysical element a little bit, because I make the argument that we can look at the science of consciousness, which teaches us about natural law through the golden rule and near-death experiences, and we can apply that and say the way we do government violates that. But I was looking into the metaphysics a little bit, and I make a few comments talking about otherworldly intelligences. And I'm like, you know, traditional political theory doesn't think about how these forces influence the political structures. And I kind of left it there. So Contact in some ways is about that. I mean, it's about the idea that we're not alone, whether it's through a UFO, like a physical craft, or interdimensional beings that you experience with psychedelics or a near-death experience, or there's so many different things. The abduction phenomenon, which was studied by John Mack, the head of psychiatry at Harvard, Pulitzer Prize winner, that there are energies affecting our world. So in that way, it did tie into everything else. It tied into Liberty to some degree, but I wanted to lay everything out because it just felt like something I hadn't covered. And that's usually what my books are trying to do. I feel like I left something out, or there's something that I didn't cover adequately because I didn't know enough about it. And then I get this panic almost like, I got to correct that. I don't want to mislead people by omitting something important. So I need to put it together. And then it just turned out to be Contact next.
Right. Well, and I see it a little better now that you explained it that way. And it almost feels like in our 21st and maybe more so in the 20th century, we saw this as a subtle justification for government, and maybe even a type of government that otherwise would not be, prescribed. And you even have Ronald Reagan, you know, justifying explicitly the United Nations by saying, well, what if there's an alien threat? We all need to band together. I mean, he doesn't even say it subtly. He explicitly said we need a global government to fight, you know, extra global threats, right? So given that, you know, you've talked about, you know, government, and then in your later books, you've talked about the reset and the way our whole medicine, you know, the whole system, we call it on this show, the medical malpractice industry, because, you know, I'm a victim of it. There's so many people who are victims of the medical malpractice industry that you wouldn't ever know. You just don't, you know, you don't see these kind of scars unless somebody shows you or talks about it, or, you know, it's physically obvious. But, you know, when it comes to the overall, like, where are we? Who are we? It does feel like there are some main threats that are kind of wielded against us, these boogeymans. And I think you're kind of addressing those in a couple of your books. Would you agree with that?
I would say so. To try to understand basically what are the forces that are clearly holding back society. I mean, when I first started with an upside down thinking, a lot of my thought process was we are in ignorance about our own nature in terms of consciousness, but a lot of it is just innocent ignorance, where you have people with egos who don't want to admit that they're wrong. And it's like, eventually we're going to transcend this paradigm. I wasn't looking at it as a conspiracy, basically, where it's imposed ignorance. And my thinking has shifted a lot in the last several years, where I do think that there's something being imposed. There could be some innocent ignorance too, but at some level, whether it's physical, metaphysical, there are forces that are trying to keep us back. Government's one way of doing that. And after I wrote the Contact book, I talk about the Great Reset of the World Economic Forum, and that's a clear plan to try to hold us back. And it's done by weaponizing compassion. And I talk about this in terms of leftism versus liberalism, where leftism is this extreme weaponization of compassion, where people end up actually not being compassionate at all and not being pro-free speech and actually being very prejudicial in certain ways, even though the liberal mindset is not supposed to be prejudicial. So I was looking at all that kind of manipulation and trying to understand it and getting frustrated with it. All these smart people I know are falling for it. And I'm like, what's going on? I've got to write about this. But then I do think there was a shift with the medicine book that will lead into the cosmos discussion. So after I wrote the Reset book, I really didn't know what I was going to do next, which is what always happens. And I was just watching the craziness of the world. And I went to a conference in Tennessee called Rebels for a Cause, organized by Courtney Turner of the Courtney Turner podcast. And I would say it was mostly freedom-oriented political stuff at the conference, but I was there talking about consciousness, and there were a few other topics that weren't purely freedom-related political stuff. And one of them was Alex Zeck's talk. He hosts the podcast The Way Forward. And Alec was talking about virology and how it doesn't follow the scientific method and that no virus has ever been truly isolated, where isolation means to separate from all other things. And I actually didn't get to hear his whole talk because I was backstage right before he was on. And then they switched the timing so that I went off of backstage and got to watch the second half of his talk, because otherwise I really couldn't see him when I was backstage. And then afterwards, Alec was like, Mark, you got to look at this. It actually ties into your work on consciousness. And he and Mike Winner, Mike's from the Alpha Vedic podcast, invited me to be in their series called The End of COVID, which I recommend to your audience. It's available at theendofcovid.com. It's maybe over 100 hours of content. And I was invited to speak about my book on liberty and voluntarism and the reset and what are the political implications of COVID and how are they taking away rights. But most of that series is about germ theory and virology and health. So when The End of COVID came out and it was released and I had a few interviews in it, I just watched some of the other interviews, like Dr. Tom Cowan, Dr. Andrew Kaufman, Doctors Mark and Sam Bailey from New Zealand, like really credible mainstream doctors who were laying things out with regard to virology in a way that I hadn't heard before. And I was so reluctant to even go there because I just couldn't believe that, wait, maybe germs don't cause disease. Maybe viruses don't even exist. And there are many other reasons to explain illness, not these microbes that have been blamed falsely. But when I saw the logic that they were using, and I couldn't find any evidence to the contrary, to actually scientifically show that these microbes were causing disease, or that in the case of viruses, that they even exist, because there's no independent variable or proper controls in the studies, and there are freedom of information requests that validate this. So that was a huge shift for me. I said, I'm going to write the book. I was terrified about what people were going to think of me, and I decided to go through with it. But that was about a year ago. So like November 2023, that book came out. Right after that, and in the process of looking at these medical questions, I noticed there were a lot of people who were also questioning the cosmos. So a portion of people who were saying viruses don't exist, who I really respected, were saying we don't live on a spinning globe. And I parked that in the back of my mind. I knew people were talking about this subject. I had never really looked into it deeply. I had heard like Dave Weiss, Flat Earth Dave, on some podcasts, and he made arguments that I thought were really interesting, but I didn't have the knowledge base to really explore it. And then fast forward to April of 2024, Steve Young's book came out. He's a theoretical physics PhD. It's called A Fool's Wisdom. And in the book, he talks about the cosmos in addition to other things. He talks about alchemy as well. But in the book, he says, basically, he heard about Flat Earth, and as a credentialed PhD, he thought he would debunk it. And he spent a lot of time, and he couldn't debunk it. And he concluded that, he says, I don't know with 100% certainty what this place is, but I know with 100% certainty what it's not, and it's not a spinning globe. And he went through some of the arguments, not in super detailed fashion in terms of physics. He uses very plain language, which helped me. I'm like, whoa, there shouldn't be anyone with this level of education who's looked into it deeply who would come out on this side of it. And there's this huge movement of people that I really respect. When things, if something so big were not true and easily debunkable, I would feel like it would dissipate over time. Same thing with the no virus movement, whereas both of them seem to be gaining momentum, where people, when they look into it deeply, they say, wow, the current paradigm's off. So that was impactful to me. Then I had some conversations when I went to a conference in April 2024, Confluence in Texas, also run by Alex Zeck and The Way Forward. And a bunch of people were talking about Flat Earth, and some people were there like, very much in favor of it. And then a few other people I talked to, like Erasimos from Here for the Truth podcast, and Melly Newbeck works with Kelly Brogan. They were like, yeah, why does Flat Earth really matter? Some people here say it does. And I was like, you know, I don't really have an opinion on this, but it sparked in my mind, this is a big topic I've got to look into. So I looked into it. And the more I looked into it, it was like I looked into more of Dave Weiss's work, more of Steve Young's work, the theoretical physics PhD. I looked at a lot of Austin Whitsitt's stuff. He has multi-hour seminars on his channel, Whitsitt Gets It. And it's not just his opinion. He's pointing to like physicists and sources that I was able to look up myself. And I realized, wow, I'm in the same issue that I was in with medicine. I don't know if I want to talk about this, but I can't convince myself of mainstream cosmology. It has too many holes in it. And I decided to write the book. And by the way, Mark, when I write these books, I just send them to my publisher and I have no idea what they're going to say. Like I always wonder, maybe they're just going to say, no, Mark, we're not doing this. So I give Waterside Productions a ton of credit because they've stuck with me throughout this whole thing, not knowing where I was going to go. And I decided to go for it. And before we get into the details, where I come out in the book, because I try to be as conservative as I can be, because I want to get this message to a lot of people. And I also want to give Princeton some credit. They did a write-up in Princeton Alumni Weekly magazine on this book, and Into the Upside Down Cosmos, which anyone can look up online. So there's a little blurb. I mean, they know what's in it because I sent it to them, and they still were willing to publish it on their website. So credit to them. But the point is that I make the claim in the book that mainstream cosmology is not correct. There are too many holes in it. And that's the Big Bang, whether Earth revolves around the sun, the nature of where we live, gravity, there are holes in all these things. But to give a comprehensive model of what is true, I don't think we can actually do that currently, because we don't have the observations and the data needed to have a comprehensive model. We can have some theories, but I'm not willing to say with certainty what the truth is. It's more saying these are falsehoods that I feel confident are not true.
Yeah, and I'm excited to get through some of these falsehoods. And that seems to be a big part of your approach, is showing where these fallacies have pervaded. And I don't remember exactly the quote, but you were quoting somebody who was asked, you know, why are these findings being falsified? And they said, well, there's sociological reasons for that, right? And I think more often than not, our understanding of the world is limited in this way. And, you know, maybe there are sort of like, I don't know, restrictions on what we can know I mean, this gets into some strange metaphysical stuff, but there's a phenomena that has been sort of, I don't know if you can even say reported, but maybe observed, because these scientists are studying this thing. I forget what it's called. I think it's called the Ryzen fiber. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
So within the lamprey eel, there's a fiber that runs from the base of its spine up to the brain. And there was a German researcher who identified this, and he said, oh, this must be how the eel is not only generating electricity, but protecting itself and not, you know, affected by this electricity in a harmful way, because it's a part of its anatomy in this complicated way that I couldn't reiterate. But my point being is that another guy came along and said, oh no, you just made a mistake. That was a coagulation of chemicals. There's no such thing as the Ryzen fiber. Decades later, in Korea, a scientist finds the same thing, because, you know, using Chinese medicine, he's experimenting on whether the meridian system can be proved, right? This qi meridian system. And he was like injecting dyed phosphorus into a certain part of a mouse or a rabbit, actually. And he discovered this same exact cord going along the spine of the rabbit. On and on and on, this phenomenon has been discovered and then subsequently dismissed. And the people on the podcast I was listening to who were discussing this, they were kind of joking, like, well, maybe there are some things that you really, like, aren't supposed to learn. Like, maybe there are things that are so integral to consciousness that, like, the, you know, serendipity of life almost makes these ideas evaporate as quickly as they, you know, manifest, right? So not saying that these things can't ever be studied, but maybe we're just not there as a collective consciousness to completely synthesize this information. And that's why we have so many fallacies that are just pervading, because we're in this sort of limited mode of consciousness.
Yeah, it's a great point. And just the nature of reality itself and our ability as a biological organism to perceive things, there's just so many limitations. And what I find in paradigm after paradigm, the mainstream concept that we're taught basically excuses anomalies. Oh yeah, there's this one little thing that we don't really understand, but it's okay. We don't have to get rid of the whole model. Whereas I look at it very differently, because I want to understand, like, what's the nature of reality? Who are we? Why are we here? What does it mean to be here at all? And it's like, I use this analogy in the Cosmos book. If there's a law that says all swans are white, and the two of us go around the world and we find a million white swans, and one day we find a swan that's black, the law has been violated. The law says all swans are white. All means all. And a lot of these quote-unquote laws, like the law of gravity, Newton's gravity is unable to explain Mercury's motion around the sun in the sky. It is a model that's not comprehensive. So that means it doesn't work. And some people will say, oh, it works on local scales, but maybe not the big ones. No, the theory doesn't work if it's unable to explain something. And so what happens is all these paradigms just keep defending themselves by saying, well, we can explain the majority of things, and it's okay. There are a few things that we don't understand, but we'll fit them into our model. And then we end up with models that have huge holes in them everywhere.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. This is something that I think connects again in many ways to all of the topics you've written. All right, folks. This ad is for the men in the audience 30 and up, so skip ahead if that's not you. All right, guys, listen, don't be ashamed if you can't keep it up in bed. Maybe you're smoking too much pot or drinking too much liquor. If that's not holding you back, there might be another issue. It could be something that you're being prescribed and it's causing dysfunctional erections. Well, that's no good. We don't want you suffering from that. Hims is here to help. Their over-the-counter product might be the stealthy solution to your cock confusion.
solution. HIMSS is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments all from the comfort and privacy of your couch. HIMSS provides access to a range of doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, proven treatments like Viagra and Cialis, or their generics for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. You don't have to visit a doctor. Just answer a series of questions on their site and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free. No insurance needed. Pay one low price for your treatments online and start your free online visit today at hims.com/crazy. That's hims.com/crazy for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/crazy. The products mentioned are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Check out HIMSS and use my code CRAZY for a great deal. www.hims.com.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was a quick break to our dynamic ads. Now we're going to thank our sponsors. And remember, if you want every episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast with your host, Mystic Mark, that's me, in its entirety, sign up on the Patreon and the Substack. You'll get every episode, the full episodes, ad-free and interruption-free. Now let's take a moment to thank our sponsors. Remember, the links for the Patreon and the Substack are in the description. First and foremost, we've got The Hit Kit, the number one way to stay lit. And not only do they have brand new designs, you can custom print your own design, logo, name, etc., phrase, whatever you want on a Hit Kit and have it delivered right to you. So whatever you're smoking on is safe and sound and ready and waiting in your Hit Kit for whenever you want to get lit. All right, folks, take a Hit Kit. Use the promo code CRAZY. Check them out on Instagram at TheHitKit or go to hitkit.us wherever you browse the web. Next up, we've got BrainSupreme.co, and Adam Schell just joined me on the podcast for another interview, so I won't say much more than that. The episode is going to be released early this week, and if you listen to that episode, there's a very special deal for those who listen. So if you're interested in microdosing, Brain Supreme is the company for you. Use the promo code CRAZY15 at checkout to save 15% off. And like I said, go over to the Patreon if you want a very special deal. And like I said, there will be more information coming very soon. BrainSupreme.co for more information. And then next up, we've got rawoptics.com/crazyoptics for a discount on blue light blocking lenses. Not just the frames you see me wearing at My Family Thinks I'm Crazy when you watch me on the lives or in photos and whatnot. Those glasses, it's not the only style they have. They have a whole variety of styles of frames. But what's most important is what the lenses are doing. They have daylight lenses and nighttime lenses that help block out the blue light in your environment and help you maintain a healthy circadian rhythm. So go and check out rawoptics.com/crazyoptics for more information, or go back and listen to my interview with the founder of the company, Matt Maruka. And that is all for now. We'll be right back to this interview with Mark Gober right now. I'm your host, Mystic Mark. Thank you for tuning in. Let's get back into it.
So it's just kind of interesting to see the trajectory of all your books and how they piece together. But there's another sort of silver lining takeaway from Upside Down Cosmology, which I think connects back to your book about medicine, Upside Down Medicine. And I think it's this lack of truth is fundamentally putting us in a state of disharmony. And I'm wondering, you know, if you could speak to that, because that seems to be another one of these major themes throughout your books.
It is a really important point that I would say I'm experiencing personally, that when I learn about these new paradigms and I have my own paradigm shift, there is an added lightness. And I would say that the cosmos one might be the biggest. I'm not sure. Liberty was really big. Thinking was really big. But something about cosmos, unexpectedly, like why would I feel liberated after challenging the cosmology that I thought we lived in? And what I think now, just a hypothesis, is that maybe our health is being affected, and even our strength, if we are living in falsehoods that some part of our being and our biology knows not to be true. It's almost like if we hadn't been educated with what the authorities told us, we would never believe many of the things that we believe. Cosmology is a great example, but we can find them all over the place where we only believe something because of some like mental gymnastics and a bunch of math that someone did, or some complex stuff that people did under a microscope and we're just supposed to trust what they did, for example. And then we end up living within these falsehoods and then developing fears around them. But when the falsehoods, we start to shed them, there's something liberating about that that's probably healthy and actually keeps us in a stronger place. And for those who want to control and suppress, that's probably not a good thing, because then we become less controllable, more independent, and we don't fit along with the agenda.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think getting back to that collective consciousness idea, I don't know if this is something that you've looked into maybe in your first book, but I might not even be remembering this accurately. I think it's the 100th monkey effect, but that might be just the movie or something else. Monkey's paw. It's all confused in this ball in my brain. So, but anyways, there's this idea that, you know, snow monkeys picked up this ability to heat themselves using the thermal pools. This was something foreign to the species. And then when one group of snow monkeys began doing this, other snow monkeys on geographically separated, isolated regions also, like telekinetically, so to speak, or telepathically, started doing this same behavior. I think Rupert Sheldrake wrote about this and other people have written about this phenomena, but it does feel like that's what we're up against in many ways, is there's a sort of consensus reality that is being vied for. And to what end? I mean, maybe you've explored that when we talk about the concept of evil. I mean, what else would be evil but to like hold someone back from knowledge? But then at the same time, do we teach children, you know, how to operate firearms? Not necessarily. You know, maybe we teach them gun safety in certain circumstances, but we're not handing them machine guns and saying go learn, you know, like. So I do think that this is like a moral and ethical question too. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not fully sure, because I'd really have to understand the nature of a soul to get to that. And like, what is a soul supposed to experience within any given lifetime? And it might be a different answer for each soul, let's say, where certain things maybe you're not supposed to be exposed to or not spend time on because it's not part of your soul's path, whereas other ones you are. And then there's a counter argument to what I just said, which is that every soul has a right to certain knowledge. And I probably lean towards that with some of this stuff, like very fundamental things. Where do we live? I mean, do we have a right to not be brainwashed into believing something that can't be validated, that we're this tiny speck at following a big bang that allegedly happened 13.8 billion years ago in some faraway place that no one can validate, unless they come up with an imaginary particle called an inflaton that no one's ever come up with, for example, or no one's ever established? My point is, there are probably fundamental things that anyone is mature enough to handle, and then maybe other elements, which I know some spiritual traditions, they're very careful about the knowledge they give And I guess I'm not at that level where I know what those pieces are to even know how dangerous they are. So it might be a mix where there's certain things where maybe you'd want to be more advanced and mature before the knowledge is incorporated. And other things are really basic. Or like think about health, for example. I mean, if it's true that germ theory is not what we're told and that our health is so much more in our own hands, that would seem to be something that everyone should have access to not be basically enslaved psychologically or otherwise by a tyrannical medical system that keeps people in fear.
Well, and also keeps people in a state of ill health in order to sell them their wellness back. I mean, yeah, it's I'm right there with you. And I think I agree with that take to your point, like, you know, what can we know beyond our own soul's experience? But the fact that we have a right to know where we live, what we are, I think those are inherent rights. I agree. And when it comes to the cosmos, we have a couple ideas. I don't know that I've heard you talk about this one in particular, but I have heard you talk about dark matter. I know that's a part of the book, and I'm curious if we can maybe start with gravity and get to dark matter and maybe how this sort of fallacy has just grown so large, because it is kind of like the people who are in one paradigm are diametrically opposed to the people who maybe think the Earth is flat or any other variation of that opinion or perspective.
Yeah, the dark matter thing really pulled me in. I actually start my book with it, and it's one that I don't hear as much of in these debates. So I'll go through it slowly, but I think it hits really hard when it lands. And it's even taken like time for it to land with me, even after writing the book, of like how significant this is. So the spinning globe model of Earth relies on gravity. For example, if we didn't have gravity, then all the water would fall off the sphere, right? Very basic. In order to have a spinning globe, you need to have gravity. Gravity was conceived by Newton, and it's basically the idea that mass is attracting mass. If you drop an apple, it falls to the ground under this theory because the mass of Earth is greater than the mass of the apple. Therefore, the mass of Earth attracts the apple down. That's the belief, that there's something inherent in mass, a magical force that is pulling everything. So we live in a world where there's mass everywhere and everything's pulling everything in some perfect equilibrium where everything is the way it is right now. And galactically, things are orbiting around each other because of that mass attracts mass. However, like I said before, there are some problems with gravity, including the fact that it cannot predict Mercury's motion around the sun in the sky. It's a big hole. So many people will say, well, Newton's gravity works pretty well in certain circumstances. Maybe it doesn't do everything. But then Einstein's general relativity theory came along, which is supposed to cover up a lot of the holes of Newton's gravity. And relativity says that it's not mass attracting mass to explain motion, but rather it's that mass is bending space-time. So it looks like mass is attracting mass, but it's basically everything's warping space-time, and then you end up with the universe that we're in right now. I mean, there's some questions about space-time as an abstraction, which is a separate topic, but this is one of the leading theories in all of physics, Albert Einstein's general relativity theory, which upholds gravity. Enter dark matter. Dark matter was allegedly discovered, I say allegedly for reasons you'll see in a second, in 1933, when there was an astronomer named Fritz Zwicky who was looking at a cluster of galaxies, and they were moving very differently than what would have been expected under Einstein's gravity. In other words, there was a lot of mass that should have been there if Albert Einstein's relativity had been true, but the mass wasn't there. So it seemed like there were two options at the time. One was to say, we need to start from scratch with regard to gravity and Einstein's relativity, or we could say that there's mass that we just don't really understand that is filling in that gap. And they called that dark matter. Dark matter is now believed to make up about 25% of the universe. So let's think about this simply. The spinning globe model relies on gravity in order to work. Gravity relies on dark matter to work, right? You with me? Now I'm going to read to you a finding from a very prominent astrophysicist. His name is Pavel Krupa, professor of astrophysics at the University of Bonn in Germany, where he heads the Stellar Populations and Dynamics Research Group. And he's a professor at the Astronomical Institute of Charles University in Prague. So he and his colleagues have been looking at dark matter for over two decades, and this is the conclusion. The current cosmological model only works by postulating the existence of dark matter, a substance that has never been detected, but that is supposed to constitute approximately 25% of all the universe. But a simple test suggests that dark matter does not, in fact, exist. If it did, we would expect lighter galaxies orbiting heavier ones to be slowed down by dark matter particles, but we detect no such slowdown. A host of other observational tests support the conclusion. Dark matter is not there. The implications of this are nothing short of a revision of Einstein's theory of gravitation. So let me go back to the logic here. Spinning globe model requires gravity. Gravity requires dark matter. Dark matter has now been falsified. What does that say about the spinning globe without doing anything else? To me, it's a bombshell.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it is this murky, oh, you don't know enough to know how it works type of science where they just sort of go to, what is it called, ad hominem attack at some point where it comes down to, oh, well, you're not smart enough or you haven't studied what I've studied, right? And right. And when you're relying on that, it just becomes frivolous. But I do think that, you know, in this modern debate that is where are we and what's the shape of it, we've run into other fallacies potentially. And I think that's maybe, again, like something that should be clarified, that we're not necessarily endorsing the flat earth model by questioning the accepted cosmology. We're just saying that we need to revise the way we see our, you know, where we physically exist, if that is even physical. Because going back to what you wrote about in your first book, like, what even is a physical thing? There is no such thing according to consciousness. It's all energy.
Right, right. And if cosmology and physics are based on the belief in physical particles at the core, they might be missing something fundamental. So I do think the consciousness aspect is key to it. But to your point about these logical fallacies, I do think it's important because people often have a knee-jerk reaction. They might listen to what I just said and do all the ad hominem stuff, even though an astrophysics professor is saying that we have to revise Einstein's theory of gravity. He literally says it. But in any event, I'm sure people will be upset and say, you don't know enough. But the other fallacies are, I think the burden of proof is a really important one, which is that the burden of proof is on those who put forth the claim. So there's a claim that's being put forward that actually doesn't really align with our senses at all, like that there was a Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago that none of us could actually validate, but that's supposed to be the start of the universe, and it led to this heliocentric solar system where Earth is revolving around the sun after billions of years, and that we live on a spherical planet, and there's gravity, and all these things that are put forth as things that we should just believe are true. And this conversation and what I write about in my book is to say, we can show where there are holes in what's put forth, but that doesn't mean that we have to come up with something to replace it that's comprehensive. We might have theories, but there's no requirement to have a replacement. That leaves us in a place of saying, I don't know, which a lot of people don't really like. And the analogy I give in my book for this is, imagine you're taking a multiple choice test with a bunch of your friends in school, and the teacher says the answer is either option A, B, C, or D, and you all have to agree on it. And one person goes away and looks at it and then says, I really think the answer is option A. Another person in the group says, I've looked at this all week and I can tell you there are holes in A and I'll show you why. And the other one says, you make some really good points here. I can't refute that, but then tell me, are we going to submit B, C, or D as the answer to the teacher? And the other one comes back and says, I actually don't know because I haven't explored B, C, and D enough to have a firm conclusion on it. And then the other one says, okay, well, if you don't know it's B, C, or D, we got to go with A. And that's how a lot of people and even the scientific community work today. It's like, well, you can't tell me exactly what the cosmos is and explain everything about everything. Then it must be the current cosmology and we live on a spinning globe and it's heliocentric and there was a Big Bang or something like that. That's not true. We can make point. We can poke holes today in the model, the mainstream model, and not have a firm conclusion on what is true. So that's point one. The other important logical fallacy, this applies so much to not just cosmology, but medicine and politics even. But it's basically about jumping to conclusions about causality, meaning jumping to conclusions about why something occurred. I talk about this a lot in medicine. Like, imagine a bunch of people go to a party, and afterwards, a few people get sick with similar symptoms. And they go home and they say, I caught something. And embedded in the word caught is the belief that there was some microscopic organism that jumped from one person to another, got inside their cells in the case of a virus, replicated, and caused very specific symptoms, which is one hypothesis. But there are many other reasons people could have got sick. Maybe there were toxins in the building. Maybe they literally ate poisonous stuff in the food. Maybe they all experienced a similar emotional shock. Maybe there was an energetic exchange. We could come up with many explanations. And it's called affirming the consequent logical fallacy. The technical way of describing it is, if X, then Y, therefore X. A simple version. If it rains, then the grass outside will be wet. I go outside and see that the grass is wet. Therefore, it rained. That second sentence is very problematic because it ignores every other reason grass could be wet, like sprinklers or dew or children running by and pouring water on it or interdimensional aliens that pop into our dimension and pour water on the grass and then pop out. The point is there are many theories other than rain. And what often happens is that we get locked into a theory that can explain the phenomena, it can explain the observations, and then any new observations are forced into that model. So it's true that if you go outside and the grass is wet, maybe it did rain. In the same way that there are certain observations that the heliocentric model can explain, or the globe model can explain certain observations, but that doesn't mean that it's the correct model. A model can explain something accurately and not be correct. And that's a huge point because a lot of people, they just get stuck into their heliocentric globe spinning earth model because it can explain certain things that they observe and they don't realize that there might be other models that can explain it too. And there might be holes in their model that they don't acknowledge.
Yeah. Well, and this is really helpful because something that I've thought about a lot through the course of this show is the concept that we live in a reality that conforms to our subjective experience. And to a certain extent, I wonder if something like two simultaneous parallel realities can simultaneously exist, where someone who has been taught and entrained to know the heliocentric model lives in a physical world that resembles that to a certain extent, whereas somebody who has seen maybe the true model lives in a world that resembles that to that extent. Almost the same way that you get like these hypochondriac type people who, no matter what you do, they will continue to get sick because they've been entrained into this type of thinking where, oh, I did that, blah, now I'm sick. And you see, I mean, they're perpetually sick. They have probably like closets full of Kleenexes and on and on and on. And they never address the real root of the cause, which is a conscious one and probably a dietary and an environmental one as well. But yeah, I mean, to that effect, like, do you entertain that kind of, I don't know if this is even something we can prove, but like the idea that there are simultaneous realities that almost conform to our subjective experience?
I mean, it's all possible to some degree, because if reality, as I tend to think it is somehow not purely physical, that there's a consciousness that underlies everything, then that would imply that reality is inherently malleable, which means all kinds of weirdness could be possible that doesn't really make sense to us. But reality might just not be as fixed in the way that we think it is. And there are many phenomena, like one called psychokinesis, which is mind impacting matter. And the classic study is called the Global Consciousness Project, where there are random number generator machines set up all over the world. And this was originally done at Princeton University, run by the former dean of engineering, but it's been continued by Roger Nelson and some others like Dean Radin, where these machines are set up all over the world and they generate numbers in a random fashion, like a one or a zero. So over time, these machines produce ones and zeros at about 50-50 chance because it's totally random. And what the researchers do is they examine whether or not the machines start to behave non-randomly using statistics when there's a major world event that would, in theory, affect the collective consciousness, something where a lot of people would have a strong emotion in one direction, like Princess Diana's death or 9/11. And they find in many of these cases that there is a statistical difference. It's small but highly statistically significant to a massive scale, where it suggests that perhaps our consciousness is affecting our physical systems in some way. So, I mean, that finding opens up a lot of possibilities, sort of like what you're describing. And I'm also thinking of something I mentioned in the book, because in the book, I also talk about contact in terms of UFOs and secret space program, because like if there's a new cosmology, we have to rethink a lot of those concepts. And the secret space program is something reported by people who I think almost universally, maybe universally, have undergone extreme mind control, like MKUltra style torture, which to me raises questions about their memories. Not that they didn't go through something, but can we trust everything? But most of them say that Earth is a spinning globe. Like they have a very mainstream cosmology, at least the ones I've come across, except there's one that I mentioned in my book who doesn't. And he says that if he wanted to know what Earth is, he'd want to go up himself and not like with basically an organization that's antagonistic. I'm paraphrasing, you know, whoever's mind controlling. So I thought that was profound. But he goes, look, if you're talking about round or flat, it is so much more complex than that when you get into multidimensional realities. It's way more than people can think of. And to me, that's super profound and aligns with the way that I look at consciousness.
Yeah, I think that is something that we're going to have to come to grips with in a sense. Not that what you're, you know, because when it comes to what we can observe, there are rules or truths that can be agreed upon. And what we're talking about here, in a certain extent, are the fallacies or the errors that have pervaded and how we can show, okay, A, that doesn't add up, or B, here's something that is more applicable or makes more sense. So when it comes to something like the debate about the shape of the Earth, you hear oftentimes the curvature is a big fixation, right? Well, I observed curvature, so that means we're on this, right? But I know that you get into this with something called the azimuthal perspective, right? This is how we as human beings with two eyes see our landscape. Can you explain how that helps us maybe decompress some of these errors that we have with our observations? Like the actual tools we use to observe should be fully understood before we can trust anything that we're observing.
Yeah, this is critical. I'm really glad you brought it up, because basically the way that we see might cause us to believe something about reality that's not true. And first, I actually want to distinguish between different types of curvature. So circular curvature is not the same as spherical curvature. A sphere is something that if you're at the top of the sphere, which theoretically all of us are from our vantage point, if we live on a sphere, things should be curving down and away from us in every direction. Down and away. That's the curvature that people should be talking about, not circular curvature. Like if you were in a dome, like on a circular plane, and you could see in a dome, you might see circularity, roundness, but it's on a two-dimensional level. That's not down and away curvature. Big difference. So sometimes people say, well, I saw curvature because I was on an airplane and it was curving. Was it curving down and away? And would it even curve down and away at a significant level if you assume the radius value of the sphere that's supposed to be roughly 4,000 miles? So I think a lot of people get confused with that. But your point about perspective and this azimuthal grid of vision is really critical. And Austin Whitsitt has some great videos on this at Whitsitt Gets It, which is his YouTube channel, where he actually goes through, because some of the stuff you really need to see. But to help, if your audience can visualize this, you're on a street and there are streetlights and they're all the same height above you. The street is straight, the road's straight. If you look down, if you look straight ahead in the distance, those streetlights will look like they're moving down as they get further and further away. They're approaching basically where you can see, where your eye level is. And they eventually reach a vanishing point where you can't see any further. So that's another important point, that our eyes can't see forever. There's something called the attenuation of light where we can't see forever. And if you shine light, a flashlight in fog, it becomes more faded. So we can't see forever. But when we see far away, the objects above us look like they're moving downward. And if you apply this to our 360-degree vision, you end up with a dome of vision. And Austin explains this much better, and you can see it visually way better. And I was actually just in the Netherlands. Some of my books were published in Dutch, and my Dutch publisher brought me over there. And it's super flat in the Netherlands. So if you're driving, you can have almost 360-degree vision without much obstruction. And you can really see this dome where it looks like the clouds above you, you would think that they're setting if you thought clouds set, because right above you, they're super high, but in the distance, it looks like they're super low approaching the horizon. You end up with this circular curvature around you, but that's not spherical curvature. Really critical. So actually, circular curvature is what you would predict based on the way our eyes see, the way we perceive the world. Austin talks about we have curved visual space, but we don't see in spherical curvature. Mm. That's the key point.
Mm. Now, can we extrapolate that to what we observe with, let's say, instruments? Because in the conversation you had with Danny on Low Value Mail, there was a caller, and it was towards the end of the show, so you really didn't get a chance to fully, you know, elaborate on your point. But he was critical in general of flat earth, not so much your statements, but more so just flat earth in general. And he said something about being a pilot or navigating long distances, maybe on the ocean. And he used something like a gyroscope. And he said that this gyroscope proved his heliocentric rolling spinning ball earth model. And I want to give you a chance to talk about that and maybe explain why someone might, with an instrument like this, think that, okay, well, this conforms to my bias of how I see the world, and let's piece that apart if we can.
Yeah, so I think generally speaking, whether it's a gyroscope or something else, people can take the tidbits of data that they're getting and try to fit it into their model and then disregard the things that contradict it. And what's interesting for me is that I've had conversations with pilots who say the opposite. I was traveling abroad several months ago before I even knew I was going to write a book about this. And a guy sits next to me and he ends up telling me that he's been a pilot for over 2 decades, teaching other pilots how to fly commercially all over the world. And he said he doesn't think it's a spinning globe. He just like kind of volunteered this to me. I was like, wow, that's pretty interesting. And he was saying it's because of his gyroscope. The way his gyroscope was functioning, it told him there was never any curvature that he had to adjust for, meaning spherical down and away curvature, and he never had to adjust for Earth's motion. And he never taught any pilots to adjust for curvature or motion either. But what he did tell me is that most pilots don't think that way, and he would acknowledge some other pilots. He said they would nod at each other in a sense of knowing when they realized they weren't on a spinning globe, but he said most of the pilots, maybe like 95%, he said, are fully indoctrinated with the spinning globe. So no matter what you tell them about the gyroscope, they're going to see their version of it. That's what he told me.
Right. Right. And it is something that, you know, to a certain extent, there's a sociological, psychological reason behind this. You know, people are comfortable with what they do, and it feels good to know things. You know, you don't want to be told you're wrong. And a lot of times, unfortunately, people will defend the prospect of being right in spite of evidence that proves them otherwise. But yeah, I found that to be kind of an interesting just anecdote from that guy, because it is contrary to what you often hear people talk about. I mean, obviously, it's a case of the vocal minority, because as you point out, like 95% of pilots probably don't really recognize this. And if they do, they don't want to necessarily shake things up and risk becoming the crazy guy at work. And it's probably true with, you know, people who navigate at sea or people who navigate even submarines. We had a guy call into the show Danny does on Tuesday nights who basically attested to the dome model rather than the globe model, because of his observations underwater and with the submarine periscope, which, again, like these instruments, telescopes, binoculars, and so on and so forth, like, I'm curious if those limitations, in the same way that our eyes conform to a dome, is it that the dome is revealing the shape, you know, like almost like we're made to be in this reality, so our vision conforms to that? I mean, that seems to be in line with a lot of what we see in nature as far as symmetry and symbiosis and all these other coherent and, you know, sort of congruent laws of nature, right? That our eyes would naturally be in the dimensions of the vessel we're in, so to speak.
Hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting observation, but there are two distinct things. So there's the azimuthal grid of vision, which allows us to see in a personalized dome up to a certain point because we can't see forever.
Right.
So we have this like little dome that we're seeing within Earth. But then the alternative to the spinning globe is often that we live in a literal dome. All of Earth is a flat plane, a topographical plane, really, with peaks and valleys. But it's a plane, and there is an enclosure above us, known often as the firmament, that divides. In the Bible, they talk about the waters above and the waters below. The idea is that even outer space is a misconception, and there are people who challenge the physics of the vacuum of space coexisting next to our open system that's not enclosed under the spinning globe model, and somehow the gas pressure doesn't go out into space, which you'd think it would have to reach an equilibrium because there's such low pressure in the vacuum of space and there's non-low pressure here. And why isn't all of our atmosphere being taken out into space? And some people will say, well, gravity holds it in. In any event, and gravity may not exist in the way that we believe. But even if you do believe in gravity, there's some questions whether gravity would have the strength to hold in the atmosphere at such high altitudes when the pressure differential is so great. But in any event, this alternative view is that we live in an enclosure that might be like a dome. So the whole of Earth is a dome, and then we see in a dome. These are distinct things. You're asking a great question. Is there some kind of like fractal nature to all of this? I don't know, but they're distinct exercises. So we could have an azimuthal grid of vision that's a dome without having a dome enclosed Earth. Like they're two separate exercises you'd have to try to prove.
Right, right. Yeah, no, they're not totally intertwined in that way. And that's good to point out because I think that, again, is the trouble with some of these instruments like a gyroscope. You get taught a certain way that it works, and then you only see the world through that perspective because what you're looking at conforms to this affirming the consequence, you know, concept that, you know, I don't know what it is about our psychology, whether we're, you know, sort of lent to these sort of things or if we're maybe made to fall into these dead end ways of thinking, but yeah, there is something comfortable about these fallacies. Well, you have spelled it out for people in your now, is it seven-part series now, seven books in total?
Seven.
So I think you're doing a great job, well on your way to a whole collection here, the Mark Gober Collection, An End to Upside Down. Who knows what's next? Hopefully some of the things we've talked about in this show make it their way into future inquiries of yours. But yeah, thinking, living, liberty, contact, reset, medicine, cosmos. There's a lot to digest here, folks. So Mark, where can people go to get the most and help you the most, right? Because obviously Amazon, you can probably buy the books there, but is there a better place to pick up the books that supports you directly? Or is there any way people can support you directly if they want to?
Thank you for asking. Amazon is the best way. Many of my books are through my publisher, Waterside Productions, but they're Amazon print on demand in many of the cases,
cool.
Which enables us to print the books very quickly and get to publication. So Amazon is helpful in that regard. But
great.
They're all available in hard copy, Kindle, and Audible formats. I narrate the Audibles myself. And my website has more information. It's markgober.com, markgober.com. I should add that my second book, An End to Upside Down Living, has a picture of a globe on the cover, which was not a statement of trying to endorse heliocentrism or anything, but it was just the art that was there.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny. And I also have a podcast series called Where Is My Mind? It was produced with Blue Duck Media in 2019, but it's still very relevant because it goes into the science of the afterlife and psychic phenomena. I interviewed a Nobel Prize winner in physics, professors from UVA, Harvard, Princeton, so very high-level people. And in that podcast, in the first episode, I warn your audience, I do refer to Flat Earth, I think, or either that or the Galileo Copernican Revolution, and the idea that germs cause disease. And I was using them as examples of paradigms where the thinking shifted. I was not trying to make a point about germ theory or cosmology.
Right.
I just was very ignorant at the time.
Well, hey, there are timestamps and dates for that purpose. People grow and change, and I think that's very honorable for you to come out and tell everyone where you were wrong. Because yeah, more people need to have that muscle, and maybe our world would change at a faster pace if people weren't so stubborn. You know, we've kind of gone over that, but yeah, you're an exemplary example of somebody who has taken what they've learned in the mainstream and applied it in a really excellent way. And in this alternative way, I think we're creating, hopefully, a future mainstream that's a lot more sane, right? Like, yeah. The mainstream we have now is not, the status quo we have now is not permanent, right? And through work like yours, we can change that.
And like yours as well. I mean, your podcast and others like it are exposing people to all these concepts that maybe 10 years ago, think about how crazy all this stuff would be, like totally insane. I mean, even the notion of flat Earth or challenging the globe model 4 years ago versus today, there's a lot more openness and receptivity. So like you, I'm way optimistic regardless of what happens politically. I think the election was an important demarcation of a shift. Right. In thinking, regardless of what happens with the presidency, I think a lot of the freedom community sees that there is hope, and we are seeing basically the normalization of freedom talk, and like people who are more mainstream left, like leaving Twitter, there's a change in the guard right now, and maybe it's going to accelerate where things that might be fringe today are just not going to be very soon.
Well said. Well said, Mark. You have an open invitation to join me back on the show anytime as far as your next book or whatever comes next for you. I'm looking forward to it. Maybe per our conversation before we started recording, you'll get into history or archaeology or some of these other forbidden topics that academia has closed off and gatekept. But yeah, excellent stuff, man. I really appreciate it. And to the audience tuning in, thank you for being here. And we'll catch you on the next episode. Until then, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. All right, ladies and gentlemen, remember, this is not the full conversation. There's an entire second hour of this conversation with author Mark Gober that you're missing out on if you don't sign up on the Patreon at patreon.com/mftic or the Substack. This is myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com, but you can also go to myfamilythinksimcrazy.com where all the links are, so much more, including my bookshop.org link where you can go and see my full list of book recommendations, and Mark Gober's books are included on that list, some of them the ones that are available on bookshop.org, but there's a ton of interesting stuff on that website. It's basically the same thing as Amazon. So if you're looking for a new read, a good read, I have a ton of recommendations there. And remember, this is not the end of the episode. So go and sign up on the Patreon or the Substack. The links are in the description. We'll catch you in the second hour or the next episode. Until then, immerse yourself in the moment, wherever you are in the now. MFTIC. Broadcasting the moon matrix from the lunar surface. They want you confused like you never knew your purpose. Hopping through the portals, dismantling the machine. My family thinks I'm crazy, I can't believe what I've seen. Memories of a war, the Pleiadians and Anunnaki. Stuck within the genes of a copy of a human body. DNA fractal, the universe within me. Epiphanies of science is hoarded by the Illuminati. Puppet masters know the power of the mantra. Repeating mad lies till it has an effect on ya. Subliminal messages hijack your perception. Tricking the population with holographic projections. We see through it. The system is unraveling. I'm astral traveling through the library of the Vatican on a sacred journey. I embark with the squad for rougher spitting truth like Mark on the pod. Gotta know the facts, never hold back. Cause I ain't getting caught up in the soul trap. I dissect the fabric of reality, looking for the answers. Searching through the galaxy, you might be feeling stressed out. Depression, anxiety is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. You don't even know how powerful you are. We the
ones who gonna expose the whole facade.
I awoke in a deep underground military base. Zero recollection of how I got to this place. Alien corpses floating in glass cylinders. Must have been extracted when they crashed into us. Animal hybrids contained in the cages. A lion with the eagle head. Monkeys with reptilian faces. Losing my mind and I'm feeling desperate. I look around the room and I see no sign of an exit. All of a sudden the wall flickers away, revealing a hangar full of spacecraft. My getaway. I run to the nearest one. See a guard knock him out, rob him for his plasma gun. Hop in the ship, take the controls. They highly intuitive, I figure it out easily. Lift off, accelerate through a tunnel until I see the light. Fly into the sky, get flanked by six F-35s.
Gotta know the facts, never hold back. Cause I ain't getting caught up in the soul trap. I dissect the fabric of reality, looking for the answers. Searching through the galaxy, you might be feeling stressed out. Depression, anxiety is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. You don't even know how powerful you are. We the ones who gonna expose the whole facade.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.